Good evening. So glad that we have this time to be together tonight to sing praises to God. I appreciate the songs that Brother Mark selected, really preparing our hearts and minds for this study that we're going to be looking at as we have praised and we have professed our faith in our great God and Creator, the true and living God, the God of the Bible. Appreciate Brother Brackett and his prayer. Appreciate all of you for setting aside some time tonight on a Monday night to be with the family of God here in this place and invest in spiritual things. Your presence here tonight is a great encouragement to me, and I hope the things that we have to look at will lift you up and build you up in your faith as well. These lessons this week, we're trying to destroy doubt, and we're trying to build up faith. And I hope that you did get one of the lesson packets. There's a study guide for each lesson there, each sermon there, and as we go through and study along, we can kind of fill in the blanks together. And if I'm saying something that you'd like to talk to me about after services, that'll be great. I'll be sticking around the back of the auditorium. And really, that's another reason you have that paper. I know when I'm listening to a speaker, I'll want to say something to the guy, but by the time the service is over, boy, that thought is gone. It has flown the coop. But if I write it down, I find that I'm much better about remembering things. So write those things down and let's talk about those things. I love the opportunity, and I love that you're here. Tonight, we are going to be talking about making the case for God. And I want to be addressing a new atheist movement, those who say there is no God. A new school of atheists, the new atheist movement, who are bringing an edgier atheism to the forefront of our public thought. And I'm going tonight to be sharing with you from some of these speakers their own words, different quotations and portions from their books and from their speeches. You need to know about these preachers of atheism because they're writing New York Times best-selling books and they are sought after to come and lecture on university campuses. You're going to see their videos on YouTube, and if you say, well, I don't watch YouTube, your children and your grandchildren do. And when they want to look into their own questions, is there a God? They're going to be running across this type of material. It is incredibly popular material. So please, 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 let's pay good attention tonight as we look at those who are contending that there is no God. Some of these new atheists you might recognize. Richard Dawkins is the Oxford professor of the public understanding of science. He's written bestsellers like The Blind Watchmaker, The God Delusion, numerous other books attacking faith. Philosopher Daniel Dennett, his book Breaking the Spell. And the fellow that gets probably the most press, and he's all over YouTube, is Sam Harris. And he wrote a couple of big-time books a couple of years ago, The End of Faith, Letter to a Christian Nation. There is an absolute platform here of this new atheist movement. They contend that faith is irrational, and they are out to debunk it. They say evolution is true, and it undercuts any reason people ever had to believe in God. They say biological and social evolution explains where religion comes from. They say the Bible is archaic. They say that Bible teachings harm us. So they warn people against the Bible. They're always working to discredit the Bible. They say the Jesus of history was mortal, if he existed at all. They say that Christians in the U.S., notice this, Christians in the U.S., constitute a profound threat to democracy. They say the world would be better without any religion. And when I say they say it, they say it clever. They say it loud. They say it again and again in very accessible media. Now, you can write down as literal as much of that as you care to write down. But just so I'm not throwing stones, let me share with you the point of this new atheist movement from one of their premier spokesperson, neuroscience PhD Sam Harris. He wrote this, quote, "The point is not that we atheists can prove religion to be the cause of more harm than good, though I think this can be argued, and the balance seems to me to be swinging further toward harm each day. The point is that religion remains the only mode of discourse that encourages grown men and women to pretend to know things they manifestly do not and cannot know. If ever there was an attitude at odds with science, this is it. And the faithful are encouraged to keep shouldering this unwieldy burden of falsehood and self-deception by everyone they meet, by their co-religionists, of course, and by people of differing faith, and now with startling frequency, by scientists who claim to have no faith. Surely we can grow in altruism and refine our ethical intuitions and even explore the furthest reaches of human happiness without lying to ourselves about the nature of the universe. Well, that's a mouthful there, but I'd really like to break down some of the main ideas in this thought, again, to give you the portrait and the platform of this new atheist movement. They are zealous. They believe atheism and evolution must be preached with urgency because of the terrible threat that religion, and particularly Christianity, poses to this country, even mankind. And according to Sam Harris in his book, The End of Faith, he said parents who take their children to church are guilty of a ludicrous obscenity. What does he say here in this quote? Well, he says that religion is harmful. That's kind of a curious idea to a lot of people. Why would anyone say that religion is harmful? Don't churches just exist for social activities and social good? Well, they don't in God's plan, but that's the way a lot of people think. But the way Harris gets to this place is to begin by saying there is no God, and that religion was developed as human beings evolved to an understanding that they fare better when working together than individually. He says religion's made up by ancient peoples to help them work together. So all religions are equal. They can be addressed in blanket statements. He looks at a tribal headhunter, and he looks at the jihad of Islam, and he says that these people do this for their religion, their God. Therefore, religion does more harm than good. I want to tell you something, folks. False religion is evil. It is evil. But pure and undefiled religion, true religion, that comes from God, and it is good. You can't take it all and address it in blanket statements. He says this, all religion is false. And people who are religious are pretending to know things they manifestly cannot know. They say that we're guilty of self-deception. I personally know of no Christian who subscribes to blind faith. I profess to believe things that are reasonable to believe. There's a difference between faith and sight, and what I believe to be the case, and what I have 100% perfect empirical knowledge of, well, that might be two different things. We're going to explore that a little bit. But as we're going to see in a moment, even the atheists take an awful lot of things on faith. He says that religion is obsolete. He says if the only thing religion was here to do was to make us altruistic, which is, you know, to be a good person and helpful to other people, well, surely we don't need religion to do that. I want you to understand that as if all religion existed for was social improvement or pleasure, it doesn't. For the atheist, there's no other explanation for religion than people created it, and it's going to make people's lives better. But the word religion comes from the Latin, religare. And it means to connect. It means to tie back. It's a word describing bringing men and God together. And religion is not a bad word. I'm going to say it again. False religion, that's bad. That's evil and that's wicked. But pure and undefiled religion, true religion, that's good. That's about bringing God and man together. That comes from God. The final thing I kind of want to highlight here is he believes that science is really the way. And his problem with religion is that it is at odds with science, he says. And even in this quote, Harris shows us science is the way. A godless world makes for a better life and a better place to live. We'll consider that for just a moment. Go with me tonight on a study that looks critically and biblically at this very aggressive new atheist movement. People who say there is no God. They say there is no God, but number one, they are still people of faith. They say there is no God, but they're still people of faith. And the new atheist movement contends that science and faith, these things are exclusive. These things are incompatible. Again, quoting from Sam Harris, although it is possible to be a scientist
and still believe in God, as some scientists seem to manage it, there is no question that an engagement with scientific thinking tends to erode rather than support religious faith. There are few modes of thinking less congenial to religious faith than science is. So you turn on your brain and you think like a scientist and you never believe in religion. You'll never believe in the Bible or anything like that. And so what's that mean about people that believe in the Bible? Well, I guess something's wrong with our thinker. Well, let's put our thinking caps on. Let's tear this apart a little bit. Because what the new atheists are doing is they're celebrating an old caricature about science and religion. The old caricature of science and religion. And the caricature is this. Science is all facts. Religion is all superstition. Science is simply facts. Richard Lewontin, the Harvard geneticist, said this, quote, "The problem is to get people to reject irrational and supernatural explanations of the world, the demons that exist only in their imaginations, and to accept the social and intellectual apparatus, science, as the only begetter of truth. How can we persuade people to give up faith, but to accept science as the begetter of truth?" In other words, to take faith out of their religion and put faith into science, right? There's still people of faith. Sam Harris said this, quote, "It is worth observing that religion is the one area of our lives where faith in dogma, that is belief without sufficient evidence, is considered a virtue. If such faith is a virtue, it is a virtue that is completely unknown to scientific discourse. Science is, in fact, the one domain in which a person can win considerable prestige for proving himself wrong. In science, honesty is all. In religion, faith is all. That is about as invidious as comparisons get." So scientists are all honest, and religious folks aren't. Science is just the facts, the honest facts. Give me the facts. Nothing but the facts. Okay. And then the caricature continues, faith is just superstition. It's just backwards if you have faith. Richard Dawkins said this, quote, "Faith is a kind of mental illness, a state of mind that leads people to believe something, it doesn't matter what, in the total absence of supporting evidence. Not only in the absence of evidence, but in the teeth of evidence." Sam Harris, "In science, it is a cardinal sin to pretend to know something that you do not know. Such pretense is the very essence of religious faith." So what we're seeing here then in the caricature is that science takes nothing on faith. And they're the guys with the white lab coats and they've got the beakers. And if you read something in a science textbook, those writers have not gone anywhere that empirical data has not concretely led them. And that there could be no facts that supports religious faith at all. There could be no empirical evidence existing that would persuade a rational person there is a God. Well, let's think about what is it that empirical science deals with? What true science deals with? Two things. Two things exclusively. What can be observed and what can be reproduced in experimentation. What can be observed and what can be reproduced in experimentation. And I'll tell you this tonight, that when science confines themselves to such processes, what can be observed and what can be reproduced in experimentation, there is no great schism between science and biblical truth. There's not. It's when we start getting into these areas of the unknown, when there were no men to witness, when things are not being reproduced in experimentation, that things start to get a little bit tricky. What are you talking about? Well, here's Sam Harris putting a nice finish, veneer finish on all of this. But he said this, quote, "When scientists don't know something like why the universe came into being or how the first self-replicating molecules formed, they admit it. Pretending to know things one doesn't know is a profound liability in science. And yet it is the lifeblood of faith-based religion. When considering questions about the nature of the cosmos and our place within it, atheists tend to draw their opinions from science." Well, I just got to tell you that that's really completely contrary to my experience, and really it is laughable. I went to public schools. I went to State University, got my bachelor's degree there. I did coursework in biology and earth and sky. I had atheist professors, and as they talked about origins, which they did, and evolutionary processes, which they did, they never said once, "We don't know." And I never had a textbook I paid $150 for that said, "We don't know." Did you ever have that textbook? Where's all the beautiful honesty at? This is ridiculous. I mean, it sounds good, but it's absolutely ridiculous. It's contrary to reality. No, they presented as facts things that were unknown and unknowable and unprovable. And the ones I had, like Harris and Dawkins and other atheists, they ridiculed the people in the class that believed there was a creator. But you know, here's what I've learned, and what I wish I knew a little bit better 15 or years ago. Scientific method cannot prove atheism. And scientific method cannot prove macroevolution. Because these systems are not observable. And they have not been reproduced in experimentation. And so, atheism, an evolutionary theory, macroevolution, the molecules to man evolution, okay? The goo that somehow became a fish, that somehow became a monkey, that somehow became Joe Gordon, okay? Nobody saw that happen. And it's not happened again since. You know, it's not reproducible. Nobody's seen this. I'll tell you that you cannot prove or disprove the existence of God by scientific method. Don't be scared about that. By definition, our God transcends it. In 2 Corinthians chapter 5, in verse number 7, we walk by faith and not by sight. God is spirit, and those that worship him must worship in spirit and in truth. Okay? We believe in God. It is reason belief. But we do not know 100% that there is a God, because the only being that could know 100% about the existence of God would be that being possessing omniscience. And unless you have omniscience, you can't rule him out. God is spirit, and this means that physical tests do not apply. You cannot prove him. You cannot disprove him with beakers and weights in a laboratory. But you cannot prove this molecule-to-man evolutionary story that's the origin of all living things. The origin of life can neither be observed nor reproduced in the laboratory. And so evolutionists are choosing to believe that, but there's no way it's knowable or provable. Atheists choose to believe atheism. Evolutionists choose to believe this macroevolution story, which means that to whatever degree Christians possess mental illness for believing in God, atheists are also afflicted. And to whatever degree Christians are guilty of arrogance of they know the unknowable, atheists are condemned. And to whatever degree Christians are dishonest for their convictions, atheists are likewise liars. These new atheists say there's no God, but they are people of faith. Atheism and Christianity, it is a clash of two faith systems. So the question becomes, what is more reasonable to believe? Is it more reasonable to believe there is a God, or is it more reasonable to believe there is not? Well, these guys are preaching hard, and they're all over the internet, saying it's more reasonable to believe there's no God. Well, let's think critically and biblically about that. And I think we're going to find this. They say there's no God, but number two, their reasons for that are unreasonable. Their own reasons are unreasonable. I'm going to go back to Sam Harris. I'm just trying to give it to you in their own words so you know what it's about. You won't be shocked when you hear it on the internet. Sam Harris said this, quote, "I no more believe in the biblical God than I believe in Zeus, Isis, Thor, and the thousands of other dead gods." Everybody looked up when they said Thor. Well, anyway. So I don't believe in the biblical God that I believe in Zeus, Isis, Thor, and the thousands of other dead gods that lie buried in the mass grave we call mythology. I doubted them all equally, and for the same reason, lack of evidence. I think it's because people would rather see a picture of Thor than Sam Harris. That's probably, Chris Hemsworth's got a nice smile. But here's the issue, all right? Here's the issue. He says there's just no evidence. Reasonable people wouldn't believe that there is a God. Where do you start? Is there evidence, or is it reasonable to trust that there's a God? I like to start in the book of Hebrews. And if you would go with me to Hebrews chapter 3, in your New Testament, Hebrews chapter 3 and verse number 4, the Bible says this: "For every house is built by someone, but he who built all things is God." A house has a builder. If we see a house, that's an effect. And we can know, reasonably believe, trust, there was a builder. That's a cause for that house. Cause and effect. And I'm going to, in this section, give you three reasons that it's reasonable to believe in God. And really, the first starts right there. The evidence of the existence of God is as simple as cause and effect. I want to share with you three cause and effect evidences to show how reasonable it is to believe there's a God. First, the beginning of the universe demands a beginner. In Hebrews chapter 11 and verse number 3, Hebrews 11 verse 3, "By faith we understand that the worlds were framed by the word of God, so that the things which are seen were not made of things which are visible." We understand that there was nothing except for God. God spoke, and then there was something. It was created, but not from what was visible. The universe is here, friends. We are here. That is an effect. What caused it? What caused the universe to begin? We read in the Bible, it's God. There was a time when atheists would not concede that the universe had a beginning. They thought it was possible that matter itself was eternal. It was argued by some, such as David Brooks in his book, Necessity of Atheism. He said, if it is reasonable to assume a first cause as having always existed, why is it unreasonable to assume that the materials of the universe always existed? In other words, he's saying that even though the Bible says there was nothing and then God spoke and there's something, well, maybe there was just always something. Maybe matter itself is eternal. But scientific discoveries of the last century have only gone to show that matter is not eternal. The universe is not eternal. There was indeed a dramatic beginning. And this data is often interpreted to support a Big Bang story. But really, all it shows is the strong likelihood of a beginning, of a beginner, a creator, God. What kind of evidences are you talking about? Well, things like the second law of thermodynamics, known as the law of entropy. All right, thermodynamics is the study of matter and energy. The second law says that this universe is running out of usable energy. Quite simply, one day it's going to run out of gas. Well, what does that show? Basically, it shows that if the universe had been running on its own energy from eternity, it should have run out by now. The tank should be on empty. But it hasn't. So the universe isn't eternal. This law is also known as the law of entropy, which says that nature tends to come to disorder. Buildings deteriorate. Fruit decays. Bodies get older. You don't think a car sitting on blocks in somebody's front yard rusts out? You should drive through some neighborhoods I know in Tennessee. It happens. But I like what the Lord said. Thieves break in and steal. Moths rust. It all decays. This world's passing away. Let's go on. Second scientific discovery. The universe is expanding. 1927, Edwin Hubble. He has a very expensive telescope named after him now. But in 1927, Edwin Hubble discovered that light from distant galaxies was redder than it should be. It was redder because the universe was growing apart. It was expanding. And the light from the galaxies was changing because it was moving away from us. And he found that the light was expanding in all directions from a single point. And scientifically, this showed that there once was nothing, and then all of a sudden there was something. There was a universe that suddenly came into being. And atheists and evolutionists call that a Big Bang, but it just shows there was a beginning. There was a beginning. Radiation from this Big Bang, or this beginning moment. In 1965, two Bell Telephone Laboratory scientists discovered a radiation afterglow from what they called a Big Bang. They said the light from the Big Bang is no longer visible, but the heat can still be detected. This followed a 1948 prediction that if a Big Bang occurred, radiation could exist. The discovery confirmed the universe is not eternal. There was a beginning. And even Einstein, back in 1916, his theory of general relativity said in part, a definite beginning to all time, all matter, and all space. And he personally found the conclusion irritating because he would like the universe to be eternal and self-existent rather than relying on an outside cause. But his theory has stood a test of time. It's one of the strongest supports for a beginning. Now let me be clear. I am not preaching the Big Bang theory tonight. All I'm saying is people say the universe had a beginning. The scientists say if there was a Big Bang, there would be these effects. But I'll tell you, if there was a Genesis creation, which there was, the same effects you would expect to find. The data is the same. The laws of discovery is the same. The evolutionist, the atheist interprets it and says, oh, there's a Big Bang. And they still have this big question, who set it off? But the Christian looks at all this and says, yeah, I read about that in Hebrews chapter 11 in verse 3. There's a God and he spoke and it happened. There was an immediate beginning. Norman Geisler and Randy Douglas, they framed the question like this in their book, Bringing Your Faith to Work, quote, well, the question of questions is what caused the Big Bang or what or who caused the universe's beginning? Natural forces are ruled out. Because they were not the cause of the Big Bang. They were created at the Big Bang. Since a cause cannot come into being after its effect, something outside of nature must have been the cause. Indeed, it's God. It's God. I like this, Robert Jastrow. He was an agnostic astronomer, but he was persuaded or became persuaded at the beginning of the universe. And he wrote this, quote, now we see how the astronomical evidence leads to a biblical view of the origin of the world. The details differ, but the essential elements in the astronomical and biblical accounts of Genesis are the same. The chain of events leading to man commenced suddenly and sharply at a definite moment in time, a flash of light and energy. And I read that and I got so excited because it reminded me of something I read in the Bible one time. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. And the first thing he said was, let there be light. Light. I knew I read that somewhere before. There was a beginning. I'll tell you, the atheists like Harris don't like to linger on a question. Who began it or how did it begin? They just jump right on to, well, there was a beginning. And now look how we've been evolving ever since. He wrote this, quote, no one knows why the universe came into being. In fact, it is not entirely clear that we can coherently speak about the beginning or creation of the universe at all, as these ideas invoke the concept of time. And here we're talking about the origin of space-time itself. Although we don't know precisely how the Earth's early chemistry begat biology, we know that the diversity and the complexity we see in the living world is not a product of mere chance. Evolution is a combination of chance, mutation, and natural selection. So wow, he gets to skirt answering any question about the beginning and say, you know what, I don't think we can speak about that coherently. That's just too vast. So he goes straight to this evolutionary story, and he assumes that it accounts for the development of life. He says, we don't precisely know how the earth's early chemistry begot biology. He's taking a lot of stuff on faith. I just know it happened. I just know what's going on. But then as you consider his words, he flat contradicts himself. He says, we know that the diversity and complexity we see in the living world is not a product of mere chance. He says evolution is a combination of chance mutation and natural selection. Well, I think chance mutation is a chance. I think that goes along. I think you just said that. And natural selection simply posits that some chance mutations work and others fail. So all of it is a product of chance. And I'm here to tell you, those are some very long odds. Very long odds. But speaking of chance mutation and natural selection, that kind of leads us into the second reason I want to give you, that it's reasonable to believe there's a God, and that is the design of the universe. And I'll tell you that design demands a designer. Okay? The beginning of the universe demands a beginner. The design we observe in the universe demands a designer. And again, from Hebrews 3, verse 4, if there's a house, then there's a builder. Go with me to Romans chapter 1 and verse 20. Romans 1 and verse 20. For since the creation of the world, His invisible attributes are clearly seen, being understood by the things that are made, even his eternal power and Godhead, so that they are without excuse. What's Paul say there? You take a good look at what you can see and this creation around you, and you will be led to the inescapable conclusion. There's a creator. Somebody made this. There's design here, which means there's a designer. And there have been all sorts of wonderful sermons given and books written about the highly specialized animals, right? And their habitats. And it shows amazing design of the natural world. You can look at the human body and it is magnificent. You look at the eye and the design of the eye, or the heart and its design, or even your skin is actually the largest organ that you have in your body. And it's just amazing. But let me throw a couple of designs at you just to kind of make the point. The anthropic principle and then DNA itself. What is the anthropic principle? Well, it says that the universe is fine-tuned. And our world is fine-tuned so that humans can exist. So that people can live and live here. What are you talking about? Well, I'm just talking about like the atmosphere on our planet is just right. It's just right. The Earth's size and corresponding gravity holds a thin, but not too thin, layer of gas that protects us all from the things in space and gives us the air to breathe, and we like breathing. And oxygen makes up 21% of the atmosphere, but you know if it were 25%, fires would continually erupt. And if it were 15%, we would all suffocate. If the Earth were any smaller, like the planet Mercury, it couldn't support the atmosphere. If it were any bigger, like the planet Jupiter, the atmosphere would contain all kind of poison that would kill us. It's just the right size. Just the right atmosphere. It's just right. The distance of the Earth to the sun, it's just right. We're just right where we need to be. If we were any closer to the sun, we'd all burn up. If we're any farther away from the sun, we'd all freeze to death. The elliptical orbit of our planet allows us this narrow range of temperature. We get the four seasons that we like. Our 24-hour rotation allows the sun to warm the Earth evenly. It's just right. It's just right. The moon, it's great to have the moon. It's right where it needs to be. It's just the right size and just the right distance. Its gravity impacts the movements of our ocean currents that prevents the water from becoming stagnant, gives us the tides. We have a real important relationship as a planet with our moon. It's just right. The water all over this planet. It's a big part of our just right world. Water's amazing. Everything else in the world freezes from the bottom up. But water freezes from the top down. And everything else contracts when it freezes, but water expands. Well, that's good. Because that means in winter, ponds and rivers freeze at the surface, but the fish and the other marine creatures, they can go on living down below, doing what they need to do. Isn't it just amazing how all that just happened? So that life can just exist, just right here, and nowhere else. That's wonderful. That's design, folks. And design demands a designer. Well, that's kind of looking up out in the outer space a little bit and back at the earth. What if we look down real, real, real small and we learn just a little bit about DNA? Charles Darwin, the famed thinker, kind of responsible, or at least gets most of the credit for the evolutionary story or bioevolutionary story, he believed in a simple cell. And he said, look, over time, a simple cell evolves and it grows into something else. It becomes a more complicated cell and a more complex cell. But what scientists know today that they had no idea about back in Darwin's day is that there's no such thing as a simple cell. Because they discovered a DNA molecule. A DNA molecule, a little strand of information, that double helix model there that tells everything in your cell what to be and what to do. A single DNA molecule, the building block of all life, carries the same amount of information as one volume of an encyclopedia. Now, no one seeing an encyclopedia lying in the forest would hesitate to think that it had an intelligent cause. And so when we find a living creature composed of millions of DNA-based cells, we ought to assume that it likewise has an intelligent cause. There's information in that cell telling it what to be. Where did the information come from? That cell's designed. Who designed it? You see, DNA conveys intelligent information. Molecular biologists actually use language terms when talking about DNA. They say that there's a DNA code that must be translated. There is transcription. They use those terms to describe what it does and how it acts. Well, you can't have a code without a code maker. Design demands a designer. And even the new atheist, Richard Dawkins, and he's the thinker and the biology guy, he concedes it sure looks like it's designed in his book, The Blind Watchmaker. Biology is the study of complicated things that give the appearance of having been designed for a purpose. So if it looks like a duck, and it walks like a duck, well, there's no ducks. Everyone knows there's no ducks, right? That's kind of where he goes with this. The atheists view amazing complexity of our universe, and they can only speculate about how it came about. Biologist Leslie Orgel wrote this, quote, "The major intellectual problem presented by the origins of life is concerned with the next state, the evolution of biological organization. How did a complex, self-replicating organism evolve from an unorganized mixture of polymeric molecules? Little experimental evidence is available, so one is forced to attempt a speculative reconstruction of this phase and the origins of life." That is the longest way I ever said we made up a good story. That's what it amounts to. Because we don't like the story in the Bible. So we got to have another story. Agnostic Robert Jastrow again, he wrote this, quote, "According to this story of evolution, every tree, every blade of grass, and every creature in the sea and on land evolved out of one parent strand of molecular matter drifting lazily in a warm pool. What concrete evidence supports that remarkable theory of the origin of life? There is none." And that's where it is. So why would people believe it? Well, they choose to believe it. It's a faith system. We have two faith systems colliding here. Okay, so the beginning of the universe demands a beginner. Design of the universe demands a designer. Third, a moral law demands a moral lawgiver. Demands a moral lawgiver. Notice with me in Romans 2, verses 14 and 15. Romans 2, verses 14 and 15. For when Gentiles who do not have the law, by nature do the things in the law, these, although not having the law, are a law to themselves, who show the work of the law written in their hearts, their conscience also bearing witness, and between themselves their thoughts accusing, or else excusing them. And this you know, causes us to notice that in the interactions of people, there is a standard of moral right and moral conduct. But where does such standard come from? If human beings are really products of eternal matter, or we're spontaneous generation and random chance, why would we have any sense of moral discernment? Why would we have any sense of a standard, of an ideal of right or wrong? And in fact, Simpson observed that true atheism and evolution make morals quite inexplicable. In his book, The Meaning of Evolution, quote, man is the result, and he believes this now, man is the result of a purposeless and natural process that did not have him in mind. He was not planned. He is a state of matter, a form of life, a sort of animal, and a species of the order primates, akin nearly or remotely to all of life, and indeed to all that is material. Discovery that the universe, apart from man or before his coming, lacks and lacked any purpose or plan, has the inevitable corollary that the workings of the universe cannot provide any automatic, universal, eternal, or absolute ethical criteria of right and wrong. What does that mean? It is a mystery, folks, that if we are just lucky molecules that got smarter, we evolved. Smarter than I sounded right then. But we just hit some genetic molecular jackpot. Then why would we think there's right? Why would we think there's wrong? Why would we ever get a sense that there's been an injustice done us? I mean, why? Where does that come from? But notice how the new atheist Sam Harris, he likes to make moral judgments. Now, he shouldn't have a sense of moral judgments, but he likes to make them. In fact, he likes to make his moral judgments against God, of all people. He takes God to task. I'll give you a couple of quotes here. Quote, how is it fair for God to have designed a world which gives such ambiguous testimony to his existence? How is it fair to have created a system where belief is the crucial piece rather than being a good person? How is it fair to have created a world in which by mere accident of birth, someone who grew up Muslim can be confounded by the wrong religion? I don't see how the future of humanity is in good care with those competing orthodoxies. Well, how is it fair that you're calling something unfair when you think there's no God at all and there's no reason that you should even feel this way? It makes no sense. Again, he wrote, quote, in most cases, it seems that religion gives people bad reasons to behave well when good reasons are actually available. Ask yourself which is more moral, helping the poor out of concern for their suffering, or doing so because you think the creator of the universe wants you to do it, will reward you for doing it, or will punish you for not doing it. He likes to use the word fair again and again, but what's his standard for fairness? And where does his standard come from? And he asks, what's more moral? But what's his standard for morality? And what does he get to say? And why is his standard better than mine or Joe Gordon's? Picking on Joe tonight. Ravi Zacharias wrote a book called The End of Reason, where he really takes this new atheist movement to task. But it's really that Harris is just so morally preachy against God that he takes issue with here, and he calls him on it. Quote, Harris's antagonism toward God ends up proving that he intuitively finds some things reprehensible. He cannot explain his innate sense of right and wrong, the reality of God's law written on his heart, because there's no logical explanation for how that intuition toward morality could develop from sheer matter and chemistry. Popularly stated, I'd put it this way. When you assert that there is such a thing as evil, you must assume that there is such a thing as good. When you say there's such a thing as good, you must assume there's a moral law by which to distinguish between good and evil. There must be some standard by which to determine what is good and what is evil. And when you assume a moral law, you must posit a moral lawgiver, the source of the moral law. But it is the moral lawgiver, precisely, who atheists are trying to disprove. They undo themselves. And this might get a little bit philosophical and heady. I'm trying to make it clear. But this is a big issue. And he wants to talk about morality. Sam Harris does. So, quote, "We do not get our morality from religion. We decide what is good in our good books by recourse to moral intuitions that are at some level hardwired in us and that have been refined by thousands of years of thinking about the causes and the possibilities of human happiness." But, I mean, all he does is set it back one step. Who hardwired you to have this moral intuition? We're just getting a little bit closer to God here. But I don't think he's going to get there. C.S. Lewis did, though. He was an atheist turned believer over the course of his life, and then he became a Christian apologist and philosopher. He wrote this about his conversion. Quote, "As an atheist, my argument against God was that the universe seemed so cruel and unjust. But how had I got this idea of just and unjust? A man does not call a line crooked unless he has some idea of a straight line. What was I comparing this universe with when I called it unjust?" Well, that's exactly it. And the answer, folks, is God. It's more reasonable to believe in God. There is perfection. There is your standard. There is good. And what is less than God, what falls short of the glory of God, is bad, is evil, is sin. Let me sum up just a little bit here. It is unreasonable to say that matter is eternal. It is unreasonable to say there is no design, only random chance. It is unreasonable to make moral judgments against God or anyone else when a sense of morality cannot come from matter or chemistry or dumb luck. So, that's the point. They say there's no God, but their reasons are unreasonable. I want to go on to number three. They say there is no God, but their faith system offers no hope. What we've discovered here tonight already is that we're talking about a battle of two faith systems. Two faith systems. How do the faith systems of atheism and Christianity answer the great questions of life? This case for God is a case for life. That life exists, that life is worth the living. And in atheism, we don't know who we are. And we don't know where we came from. And we don't know if there's a grand scheme of things. And this becomes so clear when you contrast it with the Bible and with Christian teaching. The question of origin, okay? Where did we come from? How did life come to be? There's a huge difference here. What has the atheist been telling us? Well, that life is random. Life is this equation. Time, matter, random chance. And by a happy accident, you're here. Life is random. Christian view, life is a gift from God, and it is purposed. We are created in His image and for His glory. There's actually going to be a judgment on this life, so there is a purpose to it. Then in Genesis 1, verses 26 and 27, you learn you're not just some primate. You're different from animals and beasts in the field. You're a man, you're a woman, and you're made in the image of God. You're special. And there's a purpose for you. But you're not going to get that in atheism. Well, what's the meaning of life? Why are we here? The atheist tells us, well, of course there's no meaning. Life has no meaning. We're happy accidents. Can I tell you something? Just as a little bit of a side. When people say that life is meaningless, those are the words you find in suicide notes. Honestly. People have given up when they say life is meaningless, and they really believe that. But here's people preaching this to our kids and to our neighbors, that there's no God and so life is meaningless. I think that's dangerous. Life is meaningful. Life is meaningful. This is what the Bible tells us. Ecclesiastes 12 and verses 13 and 14. Here is the conclusion of the whole matter. Here's the meaning of life. Fear God and keep His commandments. This is man's all. And I personally believe that atheists don't want to recognize the Creator because it means a call for obedience. And that, yeah, there's a moral standard and you are amenable to it. But life has meaning. What about morality? Well, with atheism, of course, there's no moral absolutes. Sam Harris likes to say that God's immoral, but there's no reason for him to say that. If we're hardwired morality, we've got to be hardwired by somebody. Well, that's by God. Well, of course, there are absolutes in Christianity. It starts with our absolute God. And He tells us what is righteous and what is sin. And He shows us the consequences for choosing the greatest good, to love Him and our fellow man, or choosing to sin. There's morality, there's judgment about it. So where does all that lead in the final analysis? What about our hope in the future? Where are we going? Well, in atheism, there is no hope. We're not going anywhere. We are all on our way to being worm food. Eat, drink, tomorrow we die. That's atheism, that's the pitch. Well, that'll get you up in the morning, won't it? We came from nothing but random chance to nothing we shall return. Well, in Christianity, we have a living hope. 1 Peter chapter 1, verses 3 through 5. Because of the resurrection of Jesus Christ, we talked about that at some length last night. This world is not perfect. No, it's not. But it's the best way to the perfect world. Through the gospel of Jesus Christ, we have hope. We have confident expectation of the Lord's return. And that kind of brings me to my last point here. They say there is no God, but number four, they still look for something greater. The new atheists, our young friends that are dabbling with it, and I know that agnosticism is quite fashionable today, but they're looking for something because they're people made in the image of God. There is eternity in their hearts. So they're looking for something greater. Well, what are the atheists looking for? Well, several of them are longing for extraterrestrial life. There's something greater than us out there, and it's probably aliens, they say. Let me give you some of their words. Sam Harris, quote, "Atheists are free to admit the limits of human understanding in a way that religious people are not. It's obvious that we do not fully understand the universe. But it's even more obvious that neither the Bible nor the Quran reflects our best understanding of it. We do not know whether there is complex life elsewhere in the cosmos, but there might be. If there is, such beings could have developed an understanding of nature's laws that vastly exceeds our own. Atheists can freely entertain such possibilities. They also can admit that if brilliant extraterrestrials exist, the contents of the Bible and the Quran will be even less impressive to them than they are to human atheists." Zing. I told you, it's clever writing. It's very clever writing. So, kind of the idea is that E.T.'s out there, and E.T. knows more than God, and we kind of hope we'll get to meet E.T. But there is a recognition, there's got to be something greater than us. Richard Dawkins, quote, "If you look at the D cells of biochemistry, that's the DNA molecules and things, molecular biology, you might find a signature of some sort of designer, and that designer could well be a higher intelligence from elsewhere in the universe." Remember, he's the guy who says it looks like it's designed? Well, E.T. might be our designer. Or Alf. Alf is the guy that designed our cells, then Alf split. Am I dating myself with Alf? All right. I don't know who the new hip alien is. Alf was great. Okay, so Francis Crick. Nobel laureate, okay? Not a dummy. Quote, probably, somebody asked him, let's see, I've got this written down here. Okay, yeah, somebody asked him about where life sprang up from on Earth. He said probably because a spaceship from another planet brought spores to seed the Earth. And that's how you start having plants here. We're a big farm for ET. Okay, and they came and they planted and then they split and here we are. Carl Sagan, now Carl Sagan made a whole career out of his atheism and his quest for extraterrestrial life. And he wrote this, "It is possible that the future of human civilization depends on the receipt of interstellar messages. The aliens need to start talking to us, and if they don't, we're probably going to all kill ourselves." Maybe one more from Sagan. This is his last published work, I believe, Pale Blue Dot. Quote, "Our planet is a lonely speck in the great enveloping cosmic dark. In our obscurity, in all this vastness, there is no hint that help will come from elsewhere to save us from ourselves." He listened to outer space for a long time for his messages. And when they didn't come, I think he despaired a little bit. I think he did. But, you know, all this stuff that's said about aliens, and what does it say? We think that aliens know more than we know, and aliens are responsible for life, and aliens have the answers to give us the information. If the aliens would only give us the message, then we might find some type of redemption. You see how they're looking for something greater than themselves? Somebody that knows. Somebody that's responsible to life. Somebody that will communicate to them and tell them what they need to know to be saved. That's what Christianity has in God. Somebody who knows. Somebody who's greater. Somebody who's responsible for all life. Somebody who's communicated to us to save us. That's what we have. And this is the wonderful message of the gospel. The truth of the gospel. People are looking for God. It's like it's beneath them to say God. They'd rather say extraterrestrial life. But they're actually looking for God. And they are groping for Him. And the wonderful message of the gospel is He can be found. In Acts chapter 17, verse 27, God is near. He is not far from us. But when men stop groping for Him or they refuse to look for Him, they're still going to be groping for something. With Christianity, there's the assurance of the supernatural life. From Genesis to Revelation, there is a God. And this God loves you. And this God has done all to provide the way for you to live forever with Him in heaven through the gospel of Jesus Christ. There is a God. And He is alive. In Him we live and we survive. There is a God. And I appreciate so much your good attention tonight as we look at this very fundamental kind of a lesson in some ways. But as I said at the beginning, I want you to know there are people who are quite fervently preaching against God. And they are targeting our neighbors and our children. And it is our privilege, but our responsibility as God's people to affirm Him, to uphold Him, and to tell people, to make the case, there is a God. And we believe it. We walk by faith and not by sight. But my friend, the day is coming when we all will see. Our hope in Christ shall be realized. Our faith shall become sight. There will be a day of judgment. It will be a great and wonderful day for the people of God. It will be a most terrible day for those who have spurned Him or mocked Him or made themselves stumbling blocks to drive people away from Him. A terrible day for such people. But let me tell you about today. Today is a day of opportunity. Today is a day of salvation. Because the Lord has not returned. And His long suffering means that you can respond to His gospel. You can confess your faith. He is the Son of God. You can be baptized. You can leave here right with Christ tonight. If you're a Christian and there's sin in your life and you've strayed away from Him, you can be restored to Him tonight. You can leave here right with God. And we want to help you to do that. If we can minister to any spiritual need, we invite you to come forward and make it known now. Together we stand and sing. Won't you come?
Oh, do not let the world...